Okay, we got a short chapter tonight, and yeah, it really is, you know, pretty jam-packed at the same time, so I doubt we'll be getting out early here this evening. But I do want to continue to work with the review. As a matter of fact, just last week, I was so pleased working with the teens and young adults on Sunday mornings. I had been doing a lot of repetition with them. And then I did a sort of a little, not test exactly, I guess, last week, but I did some reading where I would just leave off a word in a given verse and ask them to fill it in. And they were doing just really a great job of remembering the material and filling in the blanks there as we were going along. And sort of to illustrate, we had a little bit of a conversation about it, just how important repetition is. You've always heard the three R's and all of that. Yeah, and I know sometimes it does, you know, get tiresome maybe, but I think all of this review really is helpful for us. And I don't do it as a space filler anymore because I don't know anything else to say, but just because I really am a believer in trying to continue to review that material as much as possible. Anna's here tonight, you know, not normally so. We may have other visitors here this evening anyway, so we'll do some review here this evening. Got a little bit more time than we will on some other chapters at least. To do so. You will recall then the first chapter is really all dedicated to Jesus the Christ. He is presented in a very powerful and an amazing manner. Hair white like wool, feet like burnished bronze. He didn't quite get that one going. But this particular picture does as good as any could, I guess, on trying to portray some kind of a semblance of this awesome one that is both the possessor and revealer of what we call the book of Revelation, but is also, I'm very certain, the one who is being revealed. So it's the revelation of Jesus in both senses of the word. And I want to keep that in our minds as we go through. This is about Jesus. It is given to Jesus. He passes it on to an angel and then to John, but it is as much about Jesus as it is owned by him. What do the seven golden lampstands represent? The churches. What are the seven stars in his right hand? The angels of those seven churches. And so Jesus is front and center in the most awesome manner in chapter 1. Then we turn to chapters 2 and 3. I built a chart for you that you have in your syllabus there. These two chapters deal with seven real, physical, actual congregations in what we refer to as Asia Minor. They are each of them dealt with individually as distinct from any other. They don't represent church ages like the Seventh-day Adventists suggest. They don't represent anything. They are actual churches who are being told about events that they have experienced and will be experiencing. So as we're reading through chapters 2 and 3, we're not looking for symbols that need to be interpreted. What we are looking at is information he is giving to them as chiefly, I suppose we might say, a warning of their needing to properly behave themselves in the light of the events that they're soon to experience. Chapter 4 is given over to glorification of our God. The entire chapter takes us up through John's eyes and through a door that stands open in heaven to the very presence of God himself. We are introduced to a number of different beings / creatures. Again, they are awesome. They deserve our respect. We would be amazed in their presence. We would recognize the superiority of them over us if we were there. And yet, as this particular picture portrays, you have the 24 elders, for instance, casting their crowns before the throne. They are all portrayed as being in obeisance to the God of heaven. So, glory to the Father. Then we come into chapter 5. Chapter 5 has now, you know, this very bizarre picture. It's even a little bit off-screen because you have these seven eyes and seven horns. The lamb has been slain and yet it is alive. And so it's strange. And it's not only awesome, but it's weird. It's kind of off-putting. You know, anytime you got seven eyes on anything, that's just so out of the ordinary as to be strange to the point of even frightening a little bit. And so hard to understand if we are to interpret the eyes or to interpret the horns, what they might represent. I don't quite know how to go about doing that. Certainly, there's been lots of different ideas, but we know what it represents. It represents Jesus, Lion from the tribe of Judah, who is the one that has been slain for our sins, who is raised from the dead. And particularly in chapter 5, glory and honor is being ascribed to him, but it's all in the context, you recall, of his having proven himself worthy to open the seven seals. Those seven seals are the topic for all the next chapters through the end of chapter 11. So chapter 5 is about this only one, Jesus, who is able to open these seals and reveal them something that would not have been known save for his having triumphed in such a manner. So then we come to chapter 6 through 11, where the seven seals are then opened. Chapter 6 gives us the first six seals. Chapter 7, we have the sealing of the 144,000. And then in chapters 8 through 11, we have the seventh seal being opened. It will have seven parts in itself, which are the seven trumpeting angels. And so we have continuing visions that are rolling forth. And as we are seeing these visions, we are awed, we are astonished, we are deeply impressed with authority and with power, but above all, brethren, starting back in chapter 6 with the opening of these first six of the seven seals, we are horrified and we are frightened. The first of the seals has to do with some sort of conquering hero. We've got this individual who goes out conquering and to conquer. And then we have war and famine and death. And then we have the prayers of the saints, followed by a terrible earthquake. It's all cataclysm, and it's all horror. It's all stuff you would not want to be a part of yourself, up to and including that fifth seal, which was a prayer for vengeance. Now, I'll harp on this as we go through the whole book, I guess. It is preeminently important. Let's read for the first time tonight from the book itself about that fifth seal. Go to chapter 6 and start the reading at verse 9. When he broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" There was given to each of them a white robe. They were told that they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, should be completed also. Along with Arthur Ogden, who wrote the commentary I recommended for you, The Avenging of the Apostles and Prophets, he convinced me in 1987, and I've thought ever more strongly about it since, that this is the theme of the entire book. This book is about avenging the blood of those saints. And as I pointed out last week, and probably every week since we got started here, I think this is the vengeance that is first referenced in Matthew chapter 23 and then throughout Matthew chapter 24. What you have is a generation, because of their having been both prepared for the Messiah and then rejecting that Messiah, who are going to be held accountable for the persecution of the saints and the murder of the apostles and prophets. And so Jesus had promised that that would take place in that generation. These people are being told now at the end of that generation that these events are the vengeance will take place in a little while. This, I think, is what the whole book is all about. Now, June, thanks for being spacious. Saw your hand up there. What you got? Okay.
When it enumerates the elders, the 12,000 from each tribe, the 144,000, that adds up to that if you're talking about elders. But
Okay. Give me just a second. I'm just about to get there. So I'll come back to that in just a second. So here's Revelation 6, 9 through 11, which is asking for something to happen. And they are told that something will happen in a little while. It isn't going to be much longer. And it's contingent upon the number of those that will be killed as they had been being filled up. Well, that's the same idea we had in Matthew chapter 23. That the blood of all of those from Abel to Zechariah whom you slew, you know, is going to be held accountable by or to that generation. So, as I'm reading Revelation, brethren, we started off with two statements in chapter 1, verse 1, and again verse 3, that these events were soon to come to pass. I haven't been able, in my own mind, as I read through those next chapters, to find anything that would suggest that the prayer that the saints are offering right here should be postponed or projected now 2,000 years into the future. If this is a vengeance in Revelation 6, 9 through 11 that still has not taken place, then it's hard to think of them as having waited only a little while. It's not a little while. It's been a long time. It's been 2,000 years. And there doesn't seem to be anything in the book that's projecting us out that far into the future. There are very specific statements about it being soon that the book opens up with. And so I take it that if I was a first century saint, I'm reading this material, and I'm seeing these kinds of visions portrayed like this, and then they're told it'll be a little while, and the ones that are praying here are told it's a little while, and I've been told as the reader in the first three verses that it's going to be a little while, I expect it to be a little while in reference to me as the receiver of the book that these events are soon to take place or shortly to take place. That's why I think it's so very important for us to remember these time references, but also what's being requested here, and especially tonight it will bear fruit for us in a minute. This vengeance idea runs throughout the entire book. Now, just to finish up with chapter 6, in verses 12 through 17 then, you have the sixth seal. That's about a great tribulation, which we also read about in Matthew chapter 24, verses 9 through 21, and we're told it would take place in that generation. And so once again, I think it's all being knit together into a first century time frame, soon to come to pass, and not being projected millenniums into the future. Then we came to Revelation chapter 7. The theme of which I suggest is just wait. In Revelation 7, he sees four angels at the four corners of the earth. They're holding back these four winds of the earth so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or on the tree. He cries out with a loud voice, and in verse 3, this angel says, "Don't harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads." That's a very similar idea to the prayer for vengeance in the preceding chapter, only a few verses earlier. These people wanted to get vengeance. They're told it'll only be a little while. There's a number of those that have to be killed. As we open up with chapter 7, these bondservants are being sealed, and I think it at least starts with those bondservants. So then we come now to the question and the material that June just asked about. Beginning in verse 4, down through verse 7, 12 Jewish tribes are named. There haven't been Jewish tribes for 2,000 years. That whole idea is first destroyed in the gospel and in the resurrection of Jesus. There is now no distinction between Jew and Gentile. But at this point in time, there still are plenty of Jews on the earth there, because in the second sense, they are Jews by race, by nationality, and they can prove it. Subsequent to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and with an extra stamp put on it in 135 AD in the Bar Kokhba revolt, where Rome again came back and beat them, you know, up to pieces, those genealogical records were lost. Nobody today could prove or could know that they are Jews. That is impossible. Absolutely impossible. And if you don't think so, ask. Ask any Jew or anybody who says they are a Jew, what tribe are you from? There's only one answer they can give. I don't know. Well, then how do you know you're a Jew? Daddy said I was. In 1948, they made us a nation, you know, subsequent to World War II there. United Nations did this thing, so I'm a Jew in that manner. Did I tell you the story about the daughter of the guide that I had in Israel and that little conversation I had with her about her being a Jew? Did I tell you that story? Okay, let me tell you that story. Again, we got time tonight, so but if this sounds familiar, please stop me. You know, but I was in Israel, and the second trip, and I had occasion with Farrell Jenkins to have a dinner one night with the man that had been our guide for 2 weeks on the first trip and for 2 weeks on the second trip. So I hadn't seen him for a week or so, you know, after the group trip on our second tour. And so he's a good friend of Farrell's. They had some business, and they said, well, you know, we need to talk about future trips and whatnot. Larry, could you spend some time with his 15-year-old daughter? Just stay here in the hotel lobby, you know, and talk while we go do our business. I'm fine, you know, okay. So I've got this 15-year-old girl who would call herself a Jew. She is an Israeli. She's been born and raised in Israel. She's never left the country in her whole life. Well, this would be fun, you know. So we sat there. The other guys were doing their private business, you know, and table away. And here we sat in this hotel lobby. And so we got to talking. And so I asked her. I said, you know, how do you like living in Israel, that sort of thing? And I do my thing. You know, what tribe are you from? Well, I don't know. How do you know you're a Jew? Now, I'm not being mean. Please, I'm not picking on a 15-year-old girl. Okay, but I'm just exploring. How do they think? And so how do you know you're a Jew? She said, well, I just am. I was born in Israel. And I said, okay, well, have you ever thought about, you know, the Bible and the Old Testament, that the only way a person could be a Jew is if they were a direct descendant of Abraham? And they could prove that. They had genealogical records. They knew that, you know, for an established fact. So there are Jews, by a biblical definition, descendants of Abraham. Have you ever thought about that? And it was just the most wonderful moment. As this little teenage girl, you know, it just drew her up so sharp. And she just said, well, I never thought about that. And that's the case. We haven't had Jews for 2,000 years by a biblical definition. There's a political definition. There's a claim to this status today. But it truly was obliterated, does not exist any longer. But at that time, it did. And so he's enumerating here 12,000 from each tribe, 144,000. These are Jews who came to Christ. Then, again, to June's question in verse 9, after these things I looked, behold, a great multitude, which no one could count from what? See, they're not Jews now, are they? No, it's every nation and tribe and people and tongues, if you had a question about it. So it is obviously Jews and Gentiles. We're marking them. And with Jews, it's a finite number, I think partly because the whole Jewish existence is going to be brought to an end with the events we're talking about in prophecy here in the book of Revelation, the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Gentiles will go on down through time to this day. They're innumerable. They're still becoming Christians as you and I are. Do you have a follow-up? Correct, yes.
Okay, but you know what's confusing about Revelation is some are actual and some are figurative. And I think people get that confused because you say, well, this is literal. I'm not talking about this particular thing. But this over here is literal and that over there is figurative. And it's very, you know, it makes people really confused.
Okay, let's spend just a minute on that. And it's a great question and observation. And it drives me as crazy as it does you, for sure. You know, as you're looking at the book, you're trying to figure out, what does it mean? And from the first verses, you were told that that's what you'll have to do for 22 chapters. It was signified, we were told, in those first three verses. Signified. So we know there are signs. We know that a sign, an estameon, represents something. And so we know that the thing itself, much of the time, is not literal. We get to chapter 12, the one I always use, Is there a literal dragon that's going to literally use his tail to literally cast one third of the stars of heaven onto the earth? Does anybody have a question about that? How big is one star in relation to the earth? Massively larger. How many stars are there? Nobody knows. Can you take physically one third of the stars of heaven and cast them onto the earth? No. So what does it represent? But then on other occasions, I'm going to look at a verse and I'll see something in it, you know, and I'll say, you know, I think that's just not symbolic at all. I think it's literal. All right? How do you choose? Now, I was raised on an ethic that I have since abandoned. And for a long time, I thought this was really solid, and it worked wonders when I was doing battle with a premillennialist. I would say, in a book like Revelation, which has declared itself to be a book of symbols, it was signified, then it must all be symbols or none of it be symbols. But you can't have it both ways, I used to say. Now, I don't know where I got that idea to begin with. It sounded good, you know, but I don't remember reading any verse or anything that would indicate that. I couldn't prove now that God limits himself so that if he opens up a book and declares it's going to be a book of signs, he can never say anything that is either physical or literal in the remainder of the book. It has to all be symbolic. But I ran with that for quite a few years, and then I just ran into a whole lot of problems with it. So June has a great observation. I trust you don't think I'm being a hypocrite here. I'm not trying to pull a wool over anybody's eyes, but I'm just trying to understand the book. What have we got here? And sure enough, sometimes I'm going to look at something and say, I don't know how to add it up better or differently than that this, I think, you know, would be very literally understood and this not. But it'll depend totally on the context. So, with the 144,000, maybe it is so that God ordained in heaven that there would only be 144,000 Jews to the number that are either saved or are the number that will be killed. Take your pick. So that then when that's filled, the vengeance will come. So when I look at that, okay, if that's the way God did it, then fine. Doesn't seem like it to me. Seems kind of crazy. Since some of the tribes are very large and others are quite small, why would he do that? Make it, you know, 12,000 from each. I just can't add it up. So I said, well, okay, currently, for June's sake, with a big caveat, I think that's a symbolic number. Okay. But I can't interpret it any further either. So okay, I think it's symbolic. Do you still love me? The book will always be confusing. Get used to it. You know, it's kind of, one of my favorite expressions is life's tough, get a helmet. You know, Revelation's tough, get a helmet. It's always going to be hard for me. As a matter of fact, next week is one of the toughest chapters of all for me. I feel very certain, brethren, about the overall scheme. That, I think, is pretty bulletproof. My problem is what Jesus just raised here tonight. Individual symbols and what they represent. Okay? And tonight we're going to have a fair amount of that. Worse next week. And so all I can say is, well, okay, it's the best I've got now. My view hasn't changed hardly at all since 1987. I'm much more firm every time I teach it. But I still struggle with individual, you know, signs. What does that sign represent? Okay, so there's chapter 7, and we're trying to get to chapter 8 here tonight. So what we have is, again, this idea of sealing the saints, wait for all the horror of those first seals, where we got the horses riding and earthquakes and all the rest of that. Wait for that until we get the sealing done. So the number gets, you know, set. Now we come to chapter 8. It's only 13 verses, so let's read all of it, and we'll go back and look at the first 6. When he broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. I went 15 seconds. And it seemed long, didn't it?
Never be any women there because
it
couldn't keep quiet.
Oh, no. You should probably leave tonight by that door as quickly as possible after that one. Okay. So Jude says, is that literally half an hour? Absolutely. And if you don't think so, you are wrong. Why? So you look at this, and you go anywhere else in the whole rest of the Bible, and you try to get a parallel, there aren't any. And so you just go, well, I wonder what that is. Okay? And so if it is not interpreted for us, and we've been told it's a book of signs, then we do the best we can to try to understand what that symbol might represent, and then we just have to let it go and be content. You know, secret things belong to God, I guess. Deuteronomy 29:29. Now, let me try to finish the reading here, though. Okay, so we go to verse 3. Excuse me, let's just start over.
Larry?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I just want to wonder if we can parallel it in our life where something has happened and people give a minute of silence. The Lamb has opened the seal. This is God's minute of silence for a half an hour.
See, amen. Amen. Well, let me read it. We'll go back to that. I know it's tempting. Verse 1. When he broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God. And seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar holding a golden censer. And much incense was given to him that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and he filled it with the fire of the altar and threw it to the earth. And there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. And the first sounded. And there came hail and fire mixed with blood. And they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up. And a third of the trees were burned up. And all the green grass was burned up. And the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood. And a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. And a third of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten, so that a third of them might be darkened, and the day might not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. And I looked, and I heard an angel flying in mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. Okay, now, Jude will tell us which of those things are literal and which are, you know, symbolic there. But as you look at that, one thing's really for certain. Is it good news? This a place you want to be living when all this goes down? What's it all about? Whoa. It's about destruction. It's about horrifying things. It's about death and suffering. It's about all the cataclysms, you know, that you can imagine. And it's just all bound up in just a few verses. So, go back now and look at the first six verses. When he broke the seventh seal, when who broke the seventh seal? The Lamb, which is Jesus, the Christ, breaks the seventh seal. How many seals are there? Seven. So this is the last one. When the last one is broken, first thing that happens is silence for about 30 minutes. So it wasn't even 30 minutes, you know, per se. It's about 30 minutes. About half an hour, and then he sees seven angels who stand before God and seven trumpets given to them, and another angel came and stood at the altar holding a golden censer. Now he got eight angels, and much incense was given to him that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. The angel took the censer, filled it with fire of the altar. What altar is that? Fifth seal. Chapter 6, verses tell me. 9, 10, and 11. These martyred saints are under this altar. They're praying for vengeance. In verse 4, the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints. It's those saints. And the angel in verse 5, he took the censer, he filled it with fire from the altar. The altar under which they were placed because they died for the testimony. They're praying for vengeance. And we take fire from that prayer of vengeance. And what do we do with it? I'm going to cast it down on the earth. That looks to me like the answer to prayer. That's what it looks like. He filled it with fire of the altar, threw it to the earth. There followed peals of thunder, sounds and flashes of lightning and earthquake. Seven angels out of seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. These are the three main things that take place in the first six verses. These things are an awesome silence. I went 15 seconds before you couldn't stand it and two of you spoke at the same time. Okay. 15 seconds. It was 30 minutes, about. So John must have just been in wonder. And by the time you've been there for 30 minutes in total silence, what happens to you? I'm guessing you get a bit edgy. No, that's anticipation. It's the last seal. Well, this is the final one. And then you're just on the edge of, you know, your toes there. What? And then, this prayer becomes the focus. Now, let's go back to chapter 5 for just a second, by the way. Go back to chapter 5 and verse 8. When he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having each one a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are what? Now that's literal. Because it's interpreted for me, I think. I know that the bowls are not literal because now I'm told what they represent. That is a symbol of what? Prayer. Okay? And then we have preparation, which I can't understand beyond the fact that I'm told that's what it is. How did the angels prepare themselves to sound? I don't know. But there was some sort of activity in which John was given to understand, uh-oh, now I see it's coming. And I don't know if it says they were given to them, if they now are, you know, standing in a different manner, if they're raising it to their lips or what, but they are now getting ready to stand. All of this is about preparation for what's going to come. And in this 30 minutes and then this short statement here about the prayer and the preparation, again, it's all about anticipation. It's all about, you know, get ready, because here it comes. And I'm guessing, again, as I've read it all these years, you know, is that you would really be very anticipatory here. It's 30 minutes of silence. They're ready to go. And by this, it would have your undivided attention. After all I've already seen, what am I going to see now? It's the last one. So here it comes in verse 7. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. And then we're just going to get a third, you know, time and time again to the end of this chapter. What does that mean? And are we counting down every, you know, leaf on a tree, one third? See, I think what John sees, he literally sees. That is, the picture before him, he can describe because literally he's seeing this happen. But what he sees needs to be interpreted. It needs to be recognized as representing something else. Now, what I'd say about this, you know, I've said it many times before, but I guess two things. In my scheme for understanding the book of Revelation, I'm looking first for these things to represent real things. I'm looking for them to be things that will shortly come to pass in the material world. I'm thinking that we should not be looking at these as being symbolic of something that in itself is almost symbolic. They're not symbols of symbols. They're symbols of realities that will take place. That's why the saints were warned in the first chapter that these things were shortly to come to pass. That's why the saints in the second and third chapter were told, in at least one case, these things were soon to come to pass. Everything, you know, is couched in those kinds of terms. So I'm looking for the symbols to have real world actual fulfillments. That's number one. And number two, I'm looking for these things to represent real world fulfillments in the not too distant future. I do that because of so many statements throughout the book that I get driven to it. I really think there's no escape from that. Very difficult for me now to see, you know, these events encompassing thousands of years. There just doesn't seem to be, certainly not to this point, anything to suggest that. So what real world events could these things represent that were soon to take place 2,000 years ago when the book was written? Now, if you'll open up your syllabus, I trust everybody has one. If you don't, you know, make sure you come forward and get one before you leave tonight. Anna, do you have one? You got one of these. You were here earlier. Aren't you? Did you get one of these for me? You got one right there. Okay. Open up to page 36, which is our chapter 8 on these first four, the trumpeting angels. And then turn to the part that just says first trumpet, 8, verse 7. Hail, fire, and blood. Okay? I'm looking for a real-world fulfillment sometime in the near future. What would it be? So, the first trumpet represents the initial invasions of Palestine, which began up in Galilee, by Vespasian, the father, who would lead it eventually to his son Titus when Nero committed suicide in 68. But for a year and a half or 2 years, he was running the show. Now, just read here. Roman siege engines, or catapults, are still, brethren, very famous for their both range and accuracy. Here's a quote from Wars, Book 3, and chapter 4, paragraph 1, which in itself I had ... You know, several times I left things out. But nor did the Romans, Josephus says, leave off either by night or by day, burning the places in the plain and killing, so that Galilee was all over filled with, guess what? But I don't want to make a whole lot out of that, you know, but it is exactly what the symbol was saying. Fire and mixed with blood. And then, in Wars, a little bit later, in a tremendous barrage, catapults shot lances into the air and stones weighing a talent, which I interpreted for you there, is about 47 pounds, were discharged together with firebrands and a hail of arrows, his word. A host of Arab bowmen with all the javelin men and swingers let go simultaneously with the artillery fire. Now, this is just two of many places where Josephus is an eyewitness of the first century events that took place within a couple of years of the writing of this book you know, describes these things in terms that are just very like what the symbols showed. So it's at least very tempting to me to say, well, you know, it looks like John saw a vision that was representative of this cataclysm of things falling out of the sky with fire and blood. Now, look up on the screen here for just a minute. This is from the 1800s pencil sketch of the city of Jerusalem from Mount Scopus. This is the very mount that Vespasian in his truce observed and ran the destruction of Jerusalem or the siege of Jerusalem from. It's the highest eminence around Jerusalem there. And you see how well you can see the entire city. Now, the 1800s, the same walls that you see today were still there. And so, you know, that's it. This is the Kidron Valley running down through this corner. Here's the Mount of Olives, actually right here. Mount of Olives is what they call this, where it's thought that Solomon built his temple because of marrying foreign wives. But it's just a lower part of the Mount of Olives. But anyway, you know, that's the way it looked in the 1800s. I've got hundreds of these old paintings and really love them because they take away all the city stuff that we have today and give you maybe a more accurate representation of what it might have looked like in the first century then. And you have people here working the fields, you know, in camps. Okay, this is what it looks like today from the same locations. It's a photograph now of looking at the city. And sure enough, there's the dome, here's the wall. You know, that's what it looks like. Kidron Valley going down, turns corner right there, goes like that, you know. So you can see how very accurate the painting was. And then, looks to me though that the guy with the camera zoomed in a little bit maybe, but look at that, how very similar those two are. This is what you would see if you're the Roman general attacking the city. And then, by the way, what they are doing is bringing their siege engines in, as Rome is so, you know, renowned, and they're hurling various things like a fiery hail into the city. Now, it gets really gruesome as Josephus describes what he was seeing and what happens when a 50-pound stone hits you at about 100 miles an hour. What it does to a human head, what it does to the rest of the body, it is just a spray of blood that fills the air, and it's all of it, you know, coming down out of the sky. So here's what one of those, just one of many of these siege engines looks like. And again, I'll read it for you, as I'm sure you can't see that. But here's a reconstruction of a Roman catapult. The smaller siege engine that threw heavy arrows was called a catapult, and larger one, a ballista. The pair of vertical coil chambers was at the front, the bow being drawn back by a windlass to the required limit of tension. The bow was released by a trigger, and the bolt shot along a trough through an aperture in the front. So here's from Vertuvius, you know, and his books of architecture there. Here are actual arrows and javelins, I guess, whatever you call those, arrowheads. But these are the very things that have been found from that assault that would have been run through this reconstructed thing and would have just filled the sky, and hundreds of these, you know, and the sky just be filled with this hail coming down. Now, here's the larger catapult. You heard the reference in the previous one, that being the smaller. Here's the larger. The largest catapults were the Onagri, which is named after the wild ass because of its kick. When this thing let go, you don't even want to be close. They threw stones of such enormous weight that they not only crushed men and horses, but broke enemy machines. When used in siege works, they could make holes in the walls, and when used by defenders, they could smash the siege towers and the wooden machines. They could be very effective against the mass ranks of the attackers. So these are being used on both sides. But the Romans, of course, have a vastly larger army, and now they've got these guys trapped in the city running out of supplies. The air is just filled with this stuff coming down, many times of which the projectiles were flaming. They certainly used, and for a long time before they ever got to Jerusalem, catapults that hurled flaming materials in there, as well as arrows and stones and whatnot. Now, Don and I saw these stones, and I can't remember if I took this picture or not, but these stones are on Masada. They are from the Romans of the first century siege, and they've been there, you know, to this day, from the subsequent 70 AD, shortly after 73, when they destroyed Masada. So that's a, you know, a stone that is larger than your head. It weighs about 50 pounds or so. You can see they're all roughly the same size, and they've been fitted so they can fit into that catapult. Now, one of these things comes so fast and so far, they can throw this thing about 1,000 feet. That's a long distance, 1,000 feet. And when it comes down, it's blowing holes in this structure which Herod built on Masada and has been standing since the first century. So we're not in Jerusalem now. It's the Dead Sea in the background. We're south of Jerusalem and east. But there's an actual collection that's left in place from the time of the Roman siege, you know, in those days. Now, these two pictures, earlier, you know, this material I collected, I don't even remember where I got it now, but was dealing with siege engines, you mentioned. Okay, the battering ram here, used in sieges, is described in Josephus 4, book 3. So, just did it. Its effectiveness and mechanism are verified by Marcus Vitruvius, the famous Roman engineer of the 1st century B.C. So I read about him earlier. That guy was a 1st century eyewitness of this stuff. He knew what he was describing. So here's a 3-story siege tower. They're on wheels. They can be pushed up against the wall or as close as possible. And from these things, they can use a battering ram down below. They got catapults up on the top. It's a phenomenally, you know, effective war machine in the 1st century. The siege towers, pulled close to the besieged walls, were manned by archers and by soldiers operating battering rams. The besiegers near the wall were protected by huts or covered with hides that reflected near arrows or boiling oil that was poured from the battlements. So here's another such ram, you know, they would have been working there, but it would have been undercover is what Vitruvius described. Here's a mock-up of what that might have looked like. You see the wheels, roll this thing up, the hides have been saturated leather and water, so they can repel flaming stuff that's inbound, and then they can lift up, you know, on these hinges, so battering rams and troops, you know, can dig or do their work, whatever they're going to do. Here's a cutaway on this one. The wheel siege platforms covered with ox hides for the protection of the men stationed in the machine to batter the wall. So, enough on all the pictures here. I need to, you know, finish up with chapter 8. But what I'm saying is this. When the last seal is opened, the first trumpeting angel reveals a fiery, bloody, sky-oriented, inbound, you know, missile system that you really don't want to be around for. You don't want to be on the receiving end. I think it's the early invasions of and beginning of the siege from Vespasian. And the thirds have to do with the fact that they didn't destroy everything. It was a typical invasion. Then, in verse 8, the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea became blood, a third of the creatures that were in the sea and had life died, a third of the ships were destroyed. Now again, in my notes, and again, mostly this page is because of getting these quotes from Josephus and seeing similarities, but with regard to the second trumpet, Rome was successful in a number of sea battles as well, battles both on the Mediterranean and on the Sea of Galilee. Witness Josephus again. Quote, towards dawn, they were struck by a violent gale. It dashed some of the ships onto the rocks. A wide area of the sea was stained with blood. The coast was covered with corpses. And the Romans, lining the beach, killed those who were cast up. The number of bodies came to 4,200. Now, again, I'm leaving a lot out. You can go to Wars, Book 3, Chapter 9, Paragraph 3, you know, and read the full quote. But what he's describing is the naval warfare that took place, and how devastating and awful that it was, with the sea just red with the blood and thick with the corpses of either the battle effects itself, or in this one case on the Sea of Galilee, you know, with a storm that served the Romans right well. All right, then we come to verse 10 and the third angel. A great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many died from the waters because, many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. What's that? And I got two ideas here again to the notes in 10 and 11, third trumpet. Most likely, and again, I'm not sure, but most likely, the drinking waters were polluted during the war and disease abounds, as that was commonly, you know, very common with any kind of warfare that you had in the first century. But there is this other alternative, and I can't remember now if it was Art that suggested this or not, and you know, I just, you know, don't know, but he suggests that Josephus himself, the author of all this material, as an eyewitness of the siege on Jerusalem, a first century Pharisee, this guy was one of the Jews' generals. And then he was defeated up at Jotapata in the north in Galilee when the first invasions took place. He defected to the Romans. And he was quite a character, to say the least. The Romans decided to spare his life and to use him. And they used him as a Jewish interpreter and mouthpiece to plead with the Jews, as well as a historian to tell the story, as, you know, one from their side. That's why we have the fullness of this book, The Wars of the Jews. When he defected, it was bad. The Jews were really, really disappointed, and they really wanted to kill him. You know, he was a turncoat. So here's another quote from Josephus himself. Again, Wars Book 3, this time Chapter 9 and Paragraphs 5 and 6, and just little bits of it. When it was learned that Josephus was alive in Roman hands, and that he was being treated by the commanding officers with respect that no prisoner could expect, they demonstrated as much anger with him for living as they had formerly expressed sorrow. The citizens were maddened by their reverses, and their disasters only added fuel to the flames and goaded them to further calamities. They therefore resolved to fall on the Romans the more vehemently. And I leave the quote there, but he goes on to explain, and an awful lot of guys are going to die as a result. They just lost their minds. They were so mad at Josephus, so they just threw themselves all the harder at the Romans and got killed, you know, all the worse. So maybe this is the bitterness, you know, in the wormwood here, a symbol of that type of bitterness. And then lastly, of course, closed for tonight. The fourth angel in verse 12. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten, so that a third of them might be darkened, and the day might not shine for a third of it, and the night the same way. And I looked and heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpets of the three angels who are about to sound." So in closing, from my notes, I've got a lot of verses there for you to check out on your own, but let me add one that I forgot to put into the notes, and actually one of my favorites, is Genesis chapter 37, verses 9 through 11. Genesis 37, verses 9, 10, and 11. Stars, brethren, of course, can and do in Scripture sometimes represent literal, physical, material, cosmic heat sources up in the sky. But they are also used repeatedly in a figurative or symbolic sense to represent powerful, influential, ruling dignitaries or political figures. Stars are frequently used in Scripture as a symbol for the leaders of a nation, whether religiously or politically. So look it up yourself. Isaiah 14, verses 3 and 4, and then 12 and 13, and then in Numbers chapter 24, verses 12 to 19. I just want to get this on the tape for those that may not have my notes. Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, and then Ezekiel chapter 32, verses 2 through 11, Daniel chapter 8, verses 8 through 10, and again in chapter 8, verses 16 through 26, and then in chapter 12, at verse 3, in Matthew chapter 24, verse 29, and again in Revelation 1:20, somehow, you know, those seven stars in his right hand represented angels. They represented some kind of a leading, powerful, authoritative, you know, figure with regard to these churches. So let me just close. I realize I've got a minute or two over, but come to Genesis chapter 37, the one that I did not put down in the notes here. But it's the first time it's used in this way, in a symbolic or representative way in Scripture. So I like this one. In Genesis 37, verse 9, Joseph had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I've had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now, brethren, that's very helpful, isn't it? Joseph has this dream. He relates it to his father, his mother, and his brothers, and they immediately get it. Oh! I, Daddy, am the sun, your mom's the moon, and your brothers are represented each by a star. The stars represented people. And in this case, a rank of authority or influence in the family structure. And we're going to bow down to you, Joseph? Well, I don't think so. Okay? Look for that understanding of stars in Ezekiel 32, Daniel 8, you know, the other places that I've shown you. And I think maybe we could be looking for it here, too. What we've got is some great star wormwood. Maybe he represents some especially powerful figure that fell somehow, and when he does, it makes people bitter, and many die because of it. Okay? Or it's the drinking one. All right, thanks for an extra couple of minutes there, which I truly do appreciate it. And I wonder, Frank, Ron's here tonight. Frank usually is, Ron's not so much because of family circumstances. Would you lead us in prayer, please?